With the dream of winning an Olympic gold medal, Jacara Anthony decided as a teenager that she would ski full-time. By 2022, she recorded the most successful season by an Australian winter sports athlete in history in the moguls. At the 2022 Olympic Games in Beijing, Jacara won every round of the competition to become just Australia's sixth ever winter gold medalist and the first since Lydia Lassila in 2010. At the 2023-24 World Cup season, she won an incredible 14 World Cup events, which is the most ever by a mogul skier in a single season. I absolutely loved hearing more about the way Jacara prepares to perform. For her, it's not about the podiums and the records. It's about challenging what is possible, not only for her, but for women and the sport as a whole. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. Jacara, welcome to the Female Athlete Project.
Thank you. Super exciting to be here. I think we've been talking about this for a while now.
Yes. Yeah. So I first met you at the FIFA Women's World Cup. It was quite cool. I was sitting with a few athletes and I spied you on the other side of the aisle. And it was really cool to meet you and have a bit of a chat. I've been a fan from afar from a long time. So it's been cool to see you a couple of times. So I'm excited that we've lined this one up.
Yeah. Back at you. Seeing you guys at the World Cup. That was super special. Made it a really fun night.
It was very, very fun. And so you're back home. Well, you're not really home.
Sort of.
In Sydney. So it was cool. I saw you on the Channel 9 show on Wide World of Sports on the weekend. So we were like, while you're here, let's make this happen. How does it feel being back home on Australian soil? Not home yet, but Australian soil.
Australian soil is close enough for me. It's so good being home. We were on the road for about 4 months, I think. Yeah, we came home for 1 week. I landed like 9:30 p.m. Christmas Day and had a week.
So, oh, right.
Yeah. So I've literally this year slept in my bed for 3 nights now.
It's not a lot, is it?
No. So I'll take Sydney.
Yeah. Nice. Very nice. What was Christmas Day like? Did you do presents when you landed?
Well, by the time I got home, it was 11:30. I'm like straight to bed.
Yeah.
You know, we got a Christmas turkey meal on the plane and they had wreaths up on the plane. So a little interesting experience.
Very nice.
Something new.
Because how does it work season-wise in the lead up to Christmas? Do you get much of a break?
So this season it ran a little longer. We had 4 locations before Christmas with 7 starts, and the last event was on the 23rd of December in Georgia in Europe, hence getting back late Christmas Day. And then there's usually a bit of a gap to the next World Cup. We had about a month this time, so we had time to come home, but it kind of depends every year if it's a long enough gap to come home, because we still need to go back overseas and train before the next competition.
Okay,
you can't go in cold. Well, you could, but I don't think it's a recipe for success.
You don't go 14 from 16 if you go in cold.
I don't think so.
We're going to get to that, but can you take us back to Jacara as a little kid and describe what she was like?
I was a pretty wild little kid. I looked very rogue half the time and pretty sure I barely even wore clothes. I was like 10 or something, lived pretty free lifestyle. We traveled a lot as a family. We spent a lot of time as a family. So obviously very important to me. I was born up in Cairns and then we moved back to Victoria when I was about 9 months old, lived in the outer suburbs of Melbourne and moved to Barwon Heads where I now live when I was about 3 years old. And so been there ever since. So that's Surf Coast in Victoria. Absolutely love the beach. All our holidays when I was younger were beach. Yeah, just couldn't get enough of it. Mum and Dad are very disappointed I'm not a pro surfer. They like just want to go to warm destinations, but that's okay. So yeah, just loved getting outdoors, doing any activities I could. And then my mum and dad, they actually met way back at Mount Buller in Victoria, one of the ski resorts. So that's kind of how the whole skiing thing started. They were just seasonal workers at the time. I think Dad was driving taxis, Mum was running lifts, something along those lines. And then when they had my brother and I got a younger brother. He's like 15 months younger than me, so we're pretty close. We kind of look like we could be twins also. So when they had us, they decided we'd go up to Mount Buller for the season. They'd put us in the local primary school on the hill and they would work up there and we'd go skiing as a family. And that was kind of intention behind that was that it was a sport that we would be able to do as a family together forever. Like we can still go and ski as a family. So it's pretty special that they've given us that.
So they feel a bit sad that you're not a pro surfer, but they kind of like brought it upon themselves by putting you into that environment.
Yeah, right? I don't think they ever thought it was going to go this far. Their intention always was after primary school, I'd just go to high school full time. We'd maybe go up some weekends and that would be it. But when I was about year five, year six, I convinced them to let me train full time. So I would actually ski nearly every day of the week and do homeschool instead of going to the school up there. So plans changed a little bit at that point. But, yeah, they were super grateful for the opportunity that they gave me and that they bought into what I was asking for.
How did the homeschool process go?
Oh, it was a little bumpy. my school back home was really good and they were able to just send me up work for my core school units and I'd do it and come back and give them what I had completed. Oftentimes wasn't as much as they were expecting. And then later on when I was doing my, so VCE, it is in Victoria, year 11, year 12, I did distance education. And then for year 12, I actually went to school for the whole year. So that was the only year that I did the whole thing. I still missed like 2 weeks at the start, but I'm counting it.
Yeah, I reckon you should.
Yeah.
How does a 10-year-old, year five, what, 10, 11-year-old make a decision that you want to train full time?
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one. So we're pretty lucky in winter sport. We've got an event, inter-school snow sports. So you get to go and compete against all the other school kids in your state and then the country if you get through the next round. And you can try every sport. So I did alpine, ski across, moguls, cross country. I did all the snowboard disciplines, like absolutely everything I could. And moguls was just the one that I really loved. I think I liked that there were so many different aspects to it that you could be working on because I'm a major perfectionist. So it gives me a lot to go away and work on. Gates and stuff in alpine didn't quite do it for me. But yeah, moguls just really stood out to me and I had a little bit of success at the inter-school level and then I was like, all right, I want to go train with the club program, which is Team Buller Riders at Mount Buller, and they train just for freestyle skiing, which is what moguls comes under. So went through that and then at those bigger competitions I got to see our national team training, competing, and then eventually in 2010, I would have been about 11 years old, was the Vancouver Winter Olympics and I saw Britt Cox competing there as a 15-year-old. And I was really lucky later on to get to be on the team alongside Britt and travel and train with her. And she was just one of my idols growing up and such a great role model for me. And seeing her there, I was like, that's what I'm going to do. So that's kind of where it started. Not quite sure what I was thinking at the time because it's a bit of an odd one. But yeah, I'm pretty happy with the outcome of following that dream.
That's really cool. I want to get into that and what your teenage years looked like. But what was it like returning to school for year 12, like even from a social perspective for someone who'd not been in that environment? Was it hard to adapt to?
I think I was pretty used to coming and going by that point. So it was pretty probably weirder for me to be there the whole year and weirder for all my friends and stuff to have me around all the time. It was a really fun year getting to actually go to a lot of milestone events, you know, a lot of 18s, a lot of birthday parties, a lot of family events that I'm usually missing. So that was really special. And that would be my favorite part about going to school for that year. I did miss out on a lot of training and competition opportunities, but I think in the long run, it didn't affect me too much. Thankfully, I came out of that year and headed into the season and had a really successful season results wise, but my body wasn't coping quite well with the training, didn't have that training load during the year. So paid a little bit for that, but we got all on top of it. And in the long run, it probably worked out well, got on top of a lot of deficits I had because they would become so obvious. So, you know, maybe good, maybe bad, who knows?
So you picked moguls. Can you explain for people who may have watched moguls but don't actually understand how it works? Can you break it down for the listeners?
Yeah. So moguls is all those bumps in the snow that you see. So our run is manufactured though. So it's a little neater than what you would be skiing if you went off-piste as public. So there's a one section of moguls and then we have a jump straight into a really long section of moguls, one more jump and then one more short section of moguls. So that's a mogul run. And then we're a judge sport. So 60% of our score comes from how we're skiing those moguls, the turns we call them. And then 20% will come from our jumps and it's how hard the jump is and how well we do it. And then the last 20% of our score comes from the time, which is they have a formula to work out a time you should ski the course in. And depending on where you are in relation to that is how you get your points.
Is the formula related to the difficulty of the jump or it's just it's for all of you, it's the same formula?
So for your jumps, the judges will watch whatever it is you're doing, decide how good it is out of 10. They've got a process for that. But then whatever jump you did, there's a degree of difficulty which your score out of 10 gets times by to get your final score.
Okay.
So if you're doing a higher degree of difficulty, you're going to end up with a higher score than a lower.
Yeah, got ya.
But you still need to do it well.
Yes, that's an important part of it. That is key. Was there someone throughout that time, like once you decided that you wanted to do it full time and had this goal and you watched Britt Cox, who really nurtured your talent and coached you? How did you go to competing on the world stage?
It's a fair journey, that one. Very lucky to have had my parents supported along the way, you know, allowing me to go and train internationally and making a family holiday out of it so that it was possible and making sure that I was able to keep skiing in Australia. But I was able to progress through the pathway as well. So I got a scholarship with the New South Wales Institute of Sport when I was 13, 14, and that gave me opportunities to work with the national team. And then I would go on camps overseas, eventually with a program called the Australian Mogul Skiing Academy, which is run by my now coach, Pete McNeil, and Kate Blamey back when it started, who also coaches me. So Pete and Kate, I've actually worked with on and off since I was about 12 years old because they were coaching club level at that time. So we've actually gone through the whole journey together, which is really unique and special. So then when I was about, I've been competing internationally since I was about 12, but when I was about 15, 16, I got my first World Cup start, which is, that's a World Cup tour for us, is the events that happen every year, runs from December through to March. There's somewhere between 10 to 16 events every year, and that's the top end of our sport. So those same people competing at World Cup will be competing at the Olympics, competing at World Championships. So pretty young to get my first start, but yeah.
How did you do it? How did you get your first start?
We had to qualify. There's a different criteria now, but at the time it was can't remember what the result was, but a particular result you had to get at the US selections event, which is America's event they use to qualify their athletes for the underpinning tour, which is the North American tour. It's just under World Cup. So we would go and compete at that, and that's right at the start of the season. Our results there would dictate if we were able to get that development start, we called it, where you just get one World Cup start, not the whole tour.
Yeah, right. Okay. Going in as a teenager, were there fellow teenagers? Were you one of the youngest? What was that process like?
I've always been one of the youngest on the team, but there were a few around my age that got selected at the same time and that have come and gone on the team over those years. But yeah, up until about Beijing, I was still one of the younger ones on especially the World Cup team. And then that flicked overnight as everyone retired. But yeah, it was cool to be a bit younger on the team, traveling. I had really great people to look up to. You know, we've got Matt Graham, Britt Cox, Brody Summers, another World Cup medalist, and heaps of other athletes on the team that were above me in the sport. And so I could really watch and learn off them, which was a really valuable experience for me.
How different is Jacara, who was 18 years old at the World Champs in Spain? I think you finished 12th.
Yeah.
To Jacara now.
Jacara then versus Jacara now is a very different story. So I have a lot of the same things, I would say, but I deal with them differently. So back then I was very scared, still am, not that confident in myself. And I really struggled with that, with training. You know, I would go out there and I would cry a lot. I wouldn't, I'd be too scared to jump some days, too scared to ski the moguls some days. And you know, that level of fear has definitely dulled down a bit, but I've also learned how to better manage my mindset, manage where my attention's going so that I can focus more on the things that are in my control and that I can do to put down the runs I need to rather than anything that could go wrong or what's terrifying about the sport. That would be the biggest change. So I would say I back myself a lot more now, a lot more confident in myself. And yeah, that fear is definitely still there, but definitely learned to manage it a lot more. That along with a whole bunch of other things I've gotten better at. And yeah, worked really hard on that with my coach Pete and with all my support crew around me. It's been a very long journey. How old am I now? 25. So we're like 7 years on from that and yeah, just coming out the other side.
Where does the fear come from? I imagine it's very steep. Is it about the jumps? Like, where does the fear come from?
All the courses are different. So some are really steep, some are really flat. Jumping has always been a really scary part of the sport for me. I've always loved the turns and that's been my strength. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite good at the jumping part, but it's always been really scary for me. I think, you know, there is that genuine consequence that you're doing an extreme sport, you crash, it hurts, you might injure yourself, you know, snow's not as soft as people think it is. And I think that played into it a lot. I think just some of the experiences I had when I was younger, they play into it. A bit of lingering fear there, fear of failure, feeling pressure from other people. So I've really learned to deal with those aspects over the years. They still never go away, but think about them differently now. And yeah, I don't know. It's been a real journey and it's really changed who I am as a person and an athlete for the better, I think.
Mm. Did you have, what were the experiences you had as a young person? Did you have some pretty bad injuries off the back of jumps?
No bad injuries. So Okay. That's the weird thing. Nice. A few crashes and stuff, but yeah, just a few bad experiences at training with a few bad experiences with coaches and they just have lingering effects.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. How have you managed to avoid some big injuries? I need to borrow a bit of that.
I've been pretty lucky on the injury front. Well, luck, hard work, I don't know what it comes down to, a bit of both probably. I only had minor injuries along the way. The worst is probably I broke my toe running through the house before the Beijing Olympics.
Good.
Yeah, that's probably the worst.
I don't imagine marathons are very fun though with a broken toe.
Oh gosh, no. Yeah. At least you're in a boot. It's not going anywhere, but
just
it hurts.
Trapped in there, but yeah. It's painful.
Yeah, but in Australia particularly, we put a really big emphasis on really nailing the fundamentals of the sport. So having strong basic skiing fundamentals, strong jumping fundamentals. And when you take the time to really build them before you progress beyond maybe what your current ability is, when you do finally get to that level where you can progress, you can do it safely, you can do it much faster, you minimize the risk of anything going wrong. And along with that, we spend so much time in the gym getting strong and fit as possible. Like the sport's pretty hard on your body. So having that strength helps you be able to manage that and also minimize the risk of injury as well.
Looking at Beijing 2022, tell us about, there was three of you that were kind of favourites for that event. You'd shared the podium throughout that World Cup year in the lead up. Can you tell us a little bit more about where your headspace was at in terms of being one of the favourites heading into a Winter Olympics?
It was a really cool season, that one. So you had myself, Henri Colmour from Japan and Perrine Lafont from France, who was the reigning Olympic champion. Pretty much that whole World Cup season, nearly every podium was the three of us in some changing order. So we had a serious rivalry going on. So heading into the Olympics, that was pretty intense, you know. There were a few of us that could take that top spot. There were other girls that if they stepped up, they'd be capable of it. So there was a lot of things going on leading into it. Very cool position to be in though, and a major privilege, you know, going into Pyeongchang, the 2018 Olympics. I was just going in for the experience. I was ranked like 14th or something. No one knew who I was. No one really cared what I was doing. So it was a very different experience than coming into Beijing as a favourite and having a lot more attention on me, a lot more eyes on me. The fact that it was a COVID Games probably helped, you know, no spectators, no family. Media didn't have quite as much access to you. So it was a little calmer, felt a little more like our World Cup events we have every week during the season nearly. So that all contributed, but I think the mental side of stuff, the mental work we put in the lead up to that was really key, and how much work we put into all the aspects, the technical side, the jumping, the strength and conditioning. That last like sort of 18 months, I think, leading into the Olympics, 12, 18 months, myself and my whole team around me, we really left no stone unturned. And I think we did everything under the sun to give me the best chance possible of going out there and doing the run that I was capable of. So by the time we got to the Olympics, I think I felt more stressed in the lead up because I was like, I have to put in so much work to all these things to put myself in the position I want to be in, that by the time I got to the Olympics, I was like, okay, I've done all the work now. I actually can't do anything else at this point to change what's going to happen. I just need to go out there and do it. So it was probably the least nervous I felt all season. It's a bizarre feeling, but really cool and really special. I was still nervous, don't get me wrong, but it was just definitely not as exacerbated as I thought it was going to be, which surprised me as well.
It's quite an interesting concept. I've chatted to Melissa Wu, the diver, before on the podcast about how they plan the dives that they're going to do in terms of difficulty as they kind of go throughout the process. Is that something with your jumps that you plan well in advance, or is it something that you change throughout competition based on where you're sitting?
I don't tend to change my jumps too much throughout the competition. I've been sticking with the cork 720 mute on the top air. So cork means it's an off-axis spin.
I was like, please explain.
Yeah. So the cork part means you're spinning off-axis, so like on your side.
Yep.
720 means it's like 720 degrees, so
yep,
two full rotations. And the mute is the way I'm grabbing my skis. So
okay,
I'm crossing them over and grabbing one. So
okay,
and at the time that I was the only girl to be competing at that season, that no girl had competed on World Cup at that time. So we came into that season and no one really knew I was capable of it and came out and started competing it. And my jump scores, I was nearly the top, had the top jump scores for every event in the lead up to the Olympics and at the Olympics. So that was really cool to be doing and pushing the sport in that area and on the world stage especially. So yeah, I do that jump, and then on the bottom air I stick to a back mute. So that's just a backflip with that same grab I do on the top air.
Just a casual backflip, eh?
It's a bit easier than the cork.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
How did you go from this young teenager who was filled with a lot of fear to be someone who was really pushing the boundaries of what women had done before in the sport?
That was really, it was a big journey.
Mm.
I've always had really big goals in the sport, and so has my coach, and we've been on the same page about wanting to push it, kind of striving for excellence and mastery in everything we do. And having such strong jumping fundamentals allowed me to go away and learn how to do these new tricks. And because I'd gotten so strong and fit and was fueling properly, that was a big game changer for me too. You know, my nutrition, I was able to go and do huge numbers on the, we call that a water ramp. So it's a plastic ramp.
Yes, talk to us about the water ramp.
Yeah, so that's key with the learning the new jumps. It's a plastic ramp into a pool at the Jeff Henke Training Centre in Brisbane, although that only opened in 2020. And prior to that, it was in Melbourne into a dam. That's where I grew up.
Yeah.
Not so glamorous.
Not so glamorous.
The one in Brisbane is epic. It's one of the best in the world, I think.
Wow.
I haven't seen many others, but I've seen a lot of footage and stuff from them, and it's up there.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So we practice our tricks into the water first, and that's how we go learn them. So the consequences are a lot lower. Still hurts if you get it wrong on water, but you're not going to, the risk of actual injury is much, much lower. So, and you can do bigger numbers because it's a bit less impact on your body.
Yeah.
So that's big game changer in learning new tricks and then taking them to snow. You've still got to make that leap when you take it to snow, which is still just as scary. You know, putting a new trick on snow is, I don't think it ever gets less scary.
Mm.
But yeah, that's kind of the process of it.
And how did it work for you in Beijing? Was it as each run, like you were just performing each run, and did you build confidence, or was it like, okay, that run's done, ticked the box, on to the next?
Definitely just trying to stay present in Beijing. That was the big key for me. So each run, knowing what it was that I needed to do. We competed over a couple of days, which is not normal for us, and the course condition changes. Well, it changes every run because the snow moves as people are skiing it. So you've got to be really thinking on your feet every run. And lost my train of thought.
Over a couple of days, the fact that the conditions were changing.
What was the question?
Were you just ticking boxes as finished each run?
Got you. Yeah, so Beijing was about staying present. So it's really easy, well, especially for me, but so many people out there, to kind of get ahead of yourself and start thinking about what the future could be. You know, am I going to win? What's going to happen if I win? How cool is that going to be? Or what I've done in the past, like, you know, oh, maybe I made a mistake on the ski out, which is when you go from the jump back into the moguls. Maybe I messed that up last time, and kind of beating yourself up for that, which I'm a sucker for. So rather than doing that, we'd spend a lot of work in the lead up on learning how to just stay in the moment, stay present. So what is it that I'm going to do next run? What can I do this run to give myself the chance to do what I need to do? Like, okay, I need to think about this on the top air. Once I'm in the middle, I'm going to think about this. But right in that moment, and when I'm not skiing, it's just about catching my thoughts that I'm thinking about what's going to happen when I win, which happened about 500 times at least that day. So
wow,
difficult. And just bring it back to the moment, like, okay, right now I just need to chill and focus on what I can do, but so hard in the moment.
Absolutely. So standing, can you talk to us, like talk to us as if you're standing about to do your final run, knowing that the gold medal is like within reach?
Oh, yeah, that's a tough one, that run. Like I said up the top, just trying to stay present, but so hard. before the run, I was actually up there with my coach, Kate, and we were just looking at the stars, like just trying to zone out, like not really think about it. I tend not to try and focus too much on my run until I'm like one or two competitors out, because if I switch on for too long, my brain just goes to mush, as I say. It just stops working, basically. So when I'm in the gate, I'm kind of running through my head what it is that I need to do on each section of the course. It changes course to course. Some of them will be trickier in certain spots than others. And then a few technical prompts I need to have. You know, maybe I'm struggling with my top air a little more there, so I need to think about a certain thing there. Like I know in Beijing, for instance, the entry, the bumps into the bottom air were really difficult, so I knew I had to slow down before it so that I could get through them properly. Things like that I'm just going over in my head so I remember to kind of think of them when I get in there, because you kind of just go to a bit of muscle memory once you're in the run and then have those prompts there. And then right before I go, I'm just trying to stay as calm as possible, and I just remind myself, like, you've got this, and that's it. We're going.
When you're in the run, you talked about muscle memory. Bez and I did a video that I didn't end up posting, and I think it was of one of your runs. We did a little green screen, and what Bez thought would be going through your mind, and it's pretty much like, ouch, 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 jump. What is actually going through your awesome. Mind?
Not that, thankfully. I'd be in a world of pain if that was the case. So as I'm going down the run, it's those same things that were happening at the top. Like, we've done so much work prior to that and so many repetitions of the skiing that that's kind of just taking care of itself with that muscle memory. And then it's those, whatever I need to think specifically for that course at the time is what's running through my head. So I don't know, like some courses I really need to think of making sure I'm getting on my outside ski, or some of them I need to make sure that I'm really hitting the mogul with the tip of my ski, or coming into the jump, I know I need to take it right or left. I know I need to come in faster than I think I want to, or slower. There's all sorts of things, and it's really course dependent, but there's probably about a million things running through my head.
Yeah.
But thankfully, ouch, ouch, ouch is not one.
Good, good. It's very novice from Bears. I like that.
I appreciate it though.
You nailed your jumps, crossed the line. Did you know already that you were an Olympic gold medalist in that moment?
At that moment, I knew that I'd done the run that I'd gone there to do. I was really proud of what I'd achieved, what we'd achieved. You know, it was a fair team effort. Couldn't have got to that point with on my own. So I was super proud. I was like, this is what I came here to do. I've shown the world what I'm capable of. I've put in the work. That's the outcome. And I was so happy with that. I believed that that was enough to take the top spot, but I would have been happy if it wasn't. And if anyone had have done a run better than that, then they deserve that top spot, like, hands down. So it was a very special feeling to be that content before you know the result. It doesn't happen all the time. So, yeah, that made it even more special.
And I read that something about your response of when you had won the gold medal, it was almost like that was the plan all along. Is that how it felt?
Well, we spend the whole 4 years, we're aiming for that gold medal, you know. At training and stuff, that's not the primary thought. You know, at the end of the day, I can't control the result, unfortunately. So I'm just out there. We've got technical stuff with the skiing that I want to achieve and the jumping that's bigger than results. You know, that's kind of stuff that I want to do that would be a bit of a legacy in the sport. But that's the goal at training. But in the back of your mind, you are planning towards this Olympic gold medal, you know, that whole 4 years, or my whole career up until that point, really. So, and you kind of don't have time to think about, oh, what if it goes wrong? What if I don't achieve that? You know, that's one of those uncontrollables at the end of the day. So you kind of just go into it thinking that that's what you're capable of and that's what you're going to strive for. And hopefully the plan all comes together. But it's once every 4 years. So many things have to come together on the day, like 30 seconds on one day every 4 years. Like, when you put it like that, it's pretty ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Yeah. When I was competing in rugby sevens at Rio and we won that gold medal, it was, to me, the feeling was relief, because it was something I'd wanted since I was a 7-year-old kid when I watched Kathy Freeman. Did you have that sense of relief, or was it more just, we've done it, tick the box, onto the next?
A little bit of all of that, you know, like a lot of pride in the fact of what we'd been able to achieve and do it at such a high level and put down a run that I was really proud of. You know, you can win with a run, depending on the event, that's maybe not your best skiing, but I think I really went out there and did what I wanted to, what I wanted to show the world. But yeah, there definitely was a bit of that relief, like, okay, we've really done it. Like, everything that we've been working for has paid off and we've come and achieved what we set out to do.
Earlier when you talked about younger Jakara that was filled with a lot of fear, you also talked about the pressure from external sources. Can you touch on that?
Yeah, I guess the pressure is an interesting one, you know, and pressure is a bit of a perception, I think. Pressure is kind of based off a lot of what, well, for me anyway, what I think other people are thinking of me, which is totally not true. So one of the biggest instances is like my coaches, like for instance, I'll think that my coach Pete is thinking something and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so much pressure. And I'll kind of let it start breaking me down. And then when I finally do tell him, he's like, when have I ever said that to you? Or he's like, I don't think that about you. So for me, I think pressure is definitely just that, like, what do you call it? It just comes from, it's still from me, I guess, even though I feel like it's coming from external sources. It's kind of like, what do you let in also?
And prior to the season you've just had, how do you feel, like, has it been something hard to manage, like being an Olympic gold medalist and starting to perform in Crystal Globes, to feel like there's people around you who start to expect that level of success from you?
It's an interesting one. After the Olympics, you know, everything in that lead up was just aimed towards that and you finally achieve it and you never give a second's thought to what happens after in the lead up. So, you know, that was our first gold medal in 12 years in winter sport. So it had been a little while. So everything that came after that, really cool. I was receiving a lot more support, a lot more sponsorship opportunity, a lot more media exposure. I got to meet some really cool people, share my story, hopefully inspire some people. And I got to see the impact that my performance at the Olympics had on people back home, which was one of the coolest parts. But with that, it is a lot more responsibility. It does take a lot more time. I'm already training so much to try and stay where I am that it took me a long period of time to learn to juggle all those different things and still do what I needed to do to keep me happy, keep me healthy, keep me loving the sport. So there was a pretty rocky 18 months after those Olympics. You know, I still had a great season the next season, won multiple events, took home the Crystal Globe in the moguls, but it was a really tough season for me. You know, I wasn't quite enjoying it like I had been in the past. And this, prior to this season where I've broken the records and stuff, it was all about kind of trying to get to a spot where I could really enjoy the sport again and, you know, get back to why I started doing it as a kid, which I've heard that's a pretty common experience among a lot of Olympians and Olympic gold medalists. You know, a few people told me that was probably going to happen, but I didn't really believe them until I was in the middle of it and then had to dig myself out of a bit of a hole.
Yeah.
But had a lot of support along the way, which has been really good.
So prior to this season, the record for the most mogul wins was 11, set by American legend Hannah Carney. Hannah Carney?
Is that Hannah Carney, right?
Carney, yeah.
She is amazing.
So that was back in the 2011-12 season that she set that record, and you've now come in and smashed it. How did it feel to take a record like that?
It was really special. So Hannah, I absolutely idolized her growing up. She was someone that I was always looking to for like technical inspiration and just how hard she trained, how strong she was, how she approached the sport. So to beat a record that she set was something I never thought I would ever achieve. And it's the first record I think I've held on the international stage, you know. I've broken a few records within Australia, especially this season, but that's the first one that is across the whole globe. And I feel like I have to clarify because people get confused. It's not just a female record. It is male or female, that one. So I think the most male wins in a season is 10 by Mikhail Kingsbury. Hannah had 11 and I've now got 14, which is absolutely mind-blowing.
Huge. Bez puts together the research for me and she, one of her questions was 14 wins from 16 events. What happened in the two you lost? She's savage.
Okay. No, I can explain this. So I got third place in the dual moguls at Idrefjäll in Sweden. So I was dueling Jalen Koff, who American, amazing athlete. She came second on to me in all the Crystal Globes this year. So had a super consistent, great season. So she beat me in the semi-final in Idrefjäll. I really messed up my jumps, which is very uncharacteristic of me. And yeah, she got me over the line. So she progressed through to ski for first place and I had to ski for third place. So
yeah, got ya.
Secured that. So that one wasn't too bad. And then we had Deer Valley this year, which was, I actually crashed. So
right.
I qualified into finals in first place and, you know, had great finals training. The course was skiing so well. But it was really weird weather. It was like raining at the bottom of the course and trying to snow at the top of the course. And after the training, it started like doing this wet snow on the top air and it wasn't getting cleared. And that stuff is really sticky. And so when I came in, the feedback I'd been getting from my coaches, I misinterpreted before the run. And I thought it was just okay, trust your feel. You're good. So I thought it was trust my feel on the speed. Like they told me it was a bit sticky. They meant go really fast, trust your feel in the air.
Kind of important to clarify.
Important to clarify. So I did not, I really got slowed down in that sticky snow and did not jump big enough. So I didn't get close to making it to my feet.
Yeah, whoa. Okay. Yeah.
So that's actually the first time I've crashed that trick on snow and the first time I've crashed in a World Cup. So that was a bit of a shock to everyone, I think, but I got up and ripped the rest of the run, so I was pretty stoked with that, and I was just devastated to not get to show what I could do. I was skiing really well there, and I was really excited to show everyone what I was capable of, but yeah, I had to wait till Jules night to get that opportunity. That was a bummer.
And for someone who is in like the peak of your career from a performance perspective, how do you deal with the little failures like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. That really would have broken me a few years ago, I think, having that sort of a performance. But this year I was able to be really like analytical about it. I was like, well, the odds of that happening were so low and it was really unfortunate, but we could actually take a lot away to learn about it in the way that we all were communicating. And I should probably watch some more people go before me when I know the conditions are tricky and stuff like that. So there are a lot of positives to take away from it. Pretty tough standing there and watching the super final ski and you're not a part of it. But it was really cool to see the other girls out there competing. They were really pushing it. So the girl that won, Olivia Giaccio, she did a cork 1080, which there's not many girls out there doing that. So cool to see her out there pushing the sport and take the win. But yeah, I was stoked for them, but you know, a little bum for me. But we bounced back really well. Like I was saying, I've learned to stay a lot more present and, you know, accept that happened in the past, know what I can change moving forward and really just focus on that.
So you came home with the 3 crystal globes.
Yeah.
They're pretty beautiful.
They're a stunning trophy.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're literally a crystal globe on a stand. Like,
that's really cool.
Yeah.
So you've come home with those, Olympic champ, most wins in history, man or woman. You don't have the world champs title. That's the one you don't have. But I feel like from talking to you and getting to know you that obviously would be incredible to tick off, but it seems like you're way more process driven than that. It's almost about how far you can push yourself to reach, to get as close to perfect as you possibly can.
Yeah, you've really nailed it there. So I don't have the world championship title. That's kind of the one that I'm now missing in my career. So definitely would be great to go out there and win that, but that's not going to be the focus for me. Focus for me, my coach, my team around me, we're really invested in that process of trying to strive for excellence, mastery in the turns, in the jumping, in the speed of the sport, in the strength and conditioning side, in the mental side, like every aspect of it as a whole, and just to get as good at it all as I can, as close to perfect as I can, like you said, and kind of push beyond where even I think I'm capable of. Is that's what's really driving me at the moment. So the results are great and I think they just come with that kind of pursuit of that process. They're a bit of a result of it, but at the end of the day, even if I don't achieve that world championship gold, I think I'm going to be pretty happy. As long as I'm out there and skiing the way that I want to, I'll be pretty proud of that.
When you eventually do retire, it's hard to work out when you're trying to push the limits. Like, how do you work out a point when you retire? How would you feel satisfied with your career?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think at this point, with the results I've achieved, I'm already satisfied. You know, I've taken an Olympic gold medal. I've broken the records for most wins in a season. I've won crystal globes. Don't have that world championships gold, but hopefully we'll get it by the time I retire. I think for me, the satisfaction will come more about what I've achieved on the technical side of the sport. You know, I really want, we've got a few athletes in our in mogul skiing who people always talk about. They've left a real legacy in the sport of how technically well they skied, what they were doing with their jumping, how dominant they were in the sport. And I'd really love to be considered as one of them when I retire, you know, have a bit of a lasting impact on the sport, that some girls and boys way down the track are still talking about me and looking at me for inspiration. That would leave me pretty satisfied, I think.
That's pretty special. We chatted before the podcast about the fact that Australia is a summer country and you're competing in a winter sport, and that a lot of the athletes who are in winter countries kind of walk down the street as celebrities and things. What's the experience been like for you as an Aussie achieving success at such a high level, but then often coming home and having to deal with the fact that it might not get as much coverage and opportunities as an athlete in the Summer Olympics?
It is an interesting one, that. So winter sport in a summer sport country. Everyone that I've interacted with is super proud of my achievements, but maybe it doesn't get as much exposure as those summer sports, so not as many people know about it. So it is harder to get support. It is harder to get that exposure. I've been pretty lucky that I've had that relatively good, especially since Beijing, but prior to that, not such a smooth ride. So yeah, I'm one of few that are getting well supported. It is very difficult in Australia, but really grateful that for those people who have come on board for the journey.
What do you think the biggest lesson you would say for maybe a young kid who might be getting into a snow sport or whatever their sport they're getting into? What do you think your piece of advice would be?
Definitely have fun, as cliche as that is. Like, there's no point doing it if you're not enjoying it. So I've loved skiing from day dot, and I just think that you need to keep looking till you find that thing that you're really passionate about and pursue that. And then in terms of if you're looking at taking that, you want to try and go to the elite level. I think not putting a ceiling on what you think is possible just because other people have only achieved so much, I think that's really important, you know. We've never had a woman compete in the Cork 720 mute before I did, and all it took was for me to go and do it. And next season we had so many more girls out there trying to compete it. So, you know, don't ever put a ceiling on what you're capable of.
Do you think, sorry, because I feel like that was a good wrap-up answer, but that's an interesting point that I just want to ask about. What do you think it is about almost a mental barrier? Like, was it something where people saw you could do it and it then removes that barrier for people being like, oh, I'm going to give that a crack too?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you can't see it, it's kind of hard to believe it unless you've kind of got that bigger picture view. So, you know, not having girls competing corks with grabs, most people wouldn't have even given it a thought, like, oh, I'm going to need to do that to be competitive, or I want to do that to push the sport. They kind of would have just been, oh, that's not really what we do, you know? Mm. So having just one person go out and do it changes the game for everyone. So that's really cool.
I love that. Thank you so much for having a chat today. I've loved the chance to get to know you and a bit more about your story and how process-driven you are. And we love supporting you from afar when you're overseas competing, and can't wait to keep watching. So good luck for the remainder of your career.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate all the support. It's nice feeling so much love from back home.
Yeah, very cool. Thanks so much for listening. If you got something out of this episode, I would absolutely love it if you could send it on to one person who you think might enjoy it. Otherwise, subscribe, give us a review, and make sure you follow us on Instagram at The Female Athlete Project to stay up to date with podcast episodes, merch drops, and of course, news and stories about epic female athletes.